This morning we noted in Luke chapter 17 and in verse 32 how that Jesus, in the midst of warning about the destruction of Jerusalem, used Lot's wife as an example for the need of the disciples to be ready, to be prepared. And in the midst of that, by using Lot's wife as an example, he is reminding them, don't look back. Don't look back when you know Jerusalem's about to be destroyed. You see the warning signs that I've given to you. This is going to come up quickly upon those who aren't aware. In the days of Noah, they didn't listen, they didn't believe, and so the flood caught them completely unprepared, except for Noah and his family, because they listened. And then Lot is used as an example. In the days of Lot, Sodom and Gomorrah, these people were living their wicked lives, and they were caught unprepared for the destruction that God literally rained down upon them. But Lot and his family were spared because of what they were willing to do, to the fact that Lot was a faithful person, and the fact that they were willing to listen. But the reason why Jesus adds on there in verse 32, but remember Lot's wife, is that there's also those, a category of people, there's the faithful, there's the wicked, but then there's the faithful who, they're still attached to that place that they've left. In the case of Lot's wife, that's why Jesus uses her as an example, is don't become so attached, don't become so anchored in this place. And remember, for the Jew, Jerusalem was their identity as a nation, and particularly the temple. And when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, it destroyed their national identity. It destroyed the records of with all the genealogies that they put so much stock into, being able to trace their lineage back to Abraham. All of that was wiped out, and Israel never, ever recovered from that. So when Jesus said, remember Lot's wife, it carried particular meaning for the Jews, in that the way in which they evaluated themselves and their place in the world, they had to give that up, realizing that when they left, they were leaving for good, because Jerusalem was not going to be there when they got back. This afternoon, I'd like to consider the root passage, the root example that Jesus is citing regarding Lot's wife. Going back to Genesis chapter 19, when the angels have come to Lot, remember they appeared like men. They seemed to be just your average traveler. Lot was waiting at the gate for these travelers so as to spare them the wickedness of the men of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we see starting in verse 15, after the angels had stayed, they'd had a meal, and now we have the mass of Sodom learning about these men being in Lot's home. They're trying to break down the door. The angels make it so that they can't find the door. And in verse 15, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. It's not that Lot was attached to the city of Sodom in that he was invested in the wickedness of Sodom. I tend to think that Lot's issue of not wanting to leave was his care and his concern for the people of Sodom. So when they took his hand, it says, while he lingered, he wasn't moving quick enough. There was no, the urgency wasn't there for Lot yet. And these angels had to grab him, grab his wife, grab his two daughters, and drag them outside the city. Say, hey, this is serious. This is urgent. This is about to happen right now. Verse 17. So it came to pass, when they had brought them outside, that they said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." The area where Sodom and Gomorrah and these other cities were, it's known as the Vale or the Valley of Siddim. And we see it mentioned in the Old Testament. And it's on the southern tip of the Dead Sea. And so when they're referring to don't stay anywhere in the plain, because this entire area, the whole Valley of Siddim, is going to be destroyed. All of the cities that were there, Sodom, Gomorrah, and there were three others by name that were mentioned specifically, five cities total, that were going to be destroyed completely. And then in verse 18, Lot said to them, "Please know, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live." A city that Lot is referencing is a city known as Zoar, on the absolute southern tip of the Dead Sea. And in verse 21, the angel said to him, "See, I have favored you concerning this thing also, and that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen up upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. So notice, Lot's out of Sodom and Gomorrah. This is early in the morning. Apparently, the sun had not yet come up yet. It was dark. Now, by the time he gets to Zoar, the sun has risen. We see in verse 24, "The Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens, and so he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground." It wasn't just the cities that he decimated. It wasn't just the people that were destroyed. Even the vegetation itself was eliminated. This entire Valley of Siddim just completely wiped out. Notice verse 26. "But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt." And then we see Abraham going early, verse 27, in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. "And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt." It's interesting, because both in chapter 18 and here in chapter 19, Abraham looks toward Sodom and Gomorrah. But the phrase in the Hebrew, "he looked," is different than the phrase in verse 26, "Lot's wife looked." These are different terms, suggesting that there was a difference in the way Abraham looked at Sodom and Gomorrah and the way Lot's wife looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah. And so we want to talk a little bit about what this may have represented and understand some lessons that we can gain when we consider not just the lessons of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot and his wife, but especially as we live here in our society, as we live here in our modern age, the lessons that continue to be a memorial for us. Just as Jesus warned, remember Lot's wife. And he didn't go into detail, Jesus didn't. He left it there, remember Lot's wife. And that was it. Because it speaks for itself. Lot's wife and what happened to her stood as a memorial for all who would come later. So, let's talk first about why Lot's wife may have looked back. Did she look back because she was curious? She wanted to see what was happening? I mean, I can imagine this great big destruction raining down. Explosions and whatnot. It might have been a horrible yet awe-inspiring show of the power of God. But nothing about Lot's wife suggests that that's all this was. Could it have been because she wanted to be able to say goodbye to this place that she had, and apparently her daughters, where she'd risen, raised her daughters, where she and Lot had settled, perhaps she had friends in these cities. She wanted to say goodbye. I don't think that was it either. There are two main components to this problem, to this issue of his wife looking back behind them. First of all, notice how that the angel specifically told them, do not look behind you. That's what he says. He says in verse 16, 17, escape for your life. Do not look behind you nor stay anywhere in the plain. Do not look behind you. Why? Why not look? Why not be able to see the awe, even though it was a horrible moment for so many wicked people, be able to see the power of the Lord? I mean, I have to admit, had I been there, I'd have been tempted to look too for that purpose. Abraham, when he's looking out over all the plain, he's seeing the end result. A massive furnace was the smoke coming up out of the land of Sodom that God had destroyed. But I suggest to you that her purpose in looking back, she broke a command. That's the first thing. But the second part of this had to do more so with her unwillingness to leave behind the very reason why God was destroying Sodom and Gomorrah and these other cities. Remember, Lot had made his choice. He chose the fertile areas when he and Abraham parted ways. Lot got first choice, and he chose this great area of the plain that was beautiful. And it had plenty of places to be able to raise his cattle, to raise his family. So Abraham went the other way. Abraham prospered. But Lot ended up having to raise his children and expose his wife to these terrible influences of the cities of Sodom, Gomorrah, and these other cities in the plain. And please note that it doesn't sound as if these cities were spread too far apart. There's some suggestions to say that all of these cities were within walking distance, so much so that you'll note that it seems the same day that the angels took Lot and his wife and his daughters out of Sodom and they started walking towards Zoar. You're talking about maybe a matter of hours by the time that they got there, in that it was early that morning. But apparently the sun had not yet risen. Then verse 23, the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. We're not talking about wide, massive distances. We're talking about walking distance. Many of these people between all of these cities surely knew each other. Many of these people had relatives in some of these other cities. And Lot's wife had some sort of connection, not to say that she had relatives there, per se, but the idea that she had a connection she was unwilling to give up. When the angel told her, do not look behind you, there was something that compelled her to do so. And it's important that we understand that the New Testament associate a spiritual application to the idea of looking behind us. To recognize that there's a lesson to be learned in the things that we escape, the life that we once led, the sins that we were once a part of, the temptations we once fell to. That when we're taught better and we know better, and we enter the path that God has set for us, that we're not to look behind us. To look behind us with yearning. To look behind us with sadness and, oh, I wish I could still live that way. I wish I still had the opportunity to do those things that I used to do. Because it sounds as if that's exactly what Lot's wife was doing. She was looking back yearning, sad, upset that she had to leave perhaps. And it's interesting because when we consider the New Testament applications of this, Paul serves as a great example. In Philippians chapter 3, Paul uses himself to describe what he was willing to turn from, what he was willing to give up in order to become a Christian. Philippians chapter 3, he goes back to the beginning. And he talks about who he is. The fact that he was born a Pharisee of the tribe of Benjamin. All of this that he had been given growing up at the feet of Gamaliel. The opportunities that had been afforded him. A rising star in the Sanhedrin. All of that he was willing to give up for the excellency of the knowledge of Jesus Christ. In verse 13 in Philippians chapter 3, Paul says, "Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended." Which is to say, verse 12, he has not yet achieved the resurrection of the dead. He has not yet achieved that spiritual form. "But one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." It's not that Paul forgot. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, Paul would bring up how that he considered himself the chief of sinners because he persecuted the church that belongs to Christ. It's not that Paul ever forgot what he did. And I'm sure there were many occasions where he remembered Stephen, where he remembered maybe faces of some of these Christians he dragged to prison in Jerusalem. But notice Paul, he describes this yearning, this desire to apprehend the resurrection from the dead. That's what his entire goal is. To be a part of that new body, to have that new form that God has promised to those who are faithful, that they will have in heaven one day, in the resurrection. So when Paul says, here's the thing, I haven't gotten there yet, but here's what I do. I forget those things that are behind. I don't allow my mistakes, the past that I have, to weigh me down. I don't look back with yearning. I don't look back with sadness in that I wish I could still be there. I don't look back and think, oh, I could have this much wealth, and I could have this much influence, and I could be at this position in the Sanhedrin. And I gave all that up. Was it worth it? Yeah, I think it was worth it. That's not how Paul thought. He says, I forget those things which are behind, and I reach forward to those things that are ahead. In Acts chapter 7 and in verse 38, Stephen brings up into the remembrance of the Jews, Moses. He says, this is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness, verse 38, with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us, talking about the giving of the Ten Commandments and the commandments for the people. Chapter 7, verse 39. Whom our fathers would not obey, but rejected. And in their hearts they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make us gods to go before us. As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Starting here in Acts chapter 7 and in verse 39, and specifically going back to the account of this in Exodus, over and over again, we see time and time again how Israel brings up how much better they had it in Egypt. At least the water in Egypt wasn't bitter. Oh, at least we had this and at least we had that, and you brought us out here to die. Over and over again, Israel thought back to Egypt, the very land in which they cried to God to deliver them as slaves from this place. And now all of a sudden that they're out, all they want to do is go back. This is that yearning, that attachment that they had. Not looking forward to what was ahead. Israel wasn't, oh, we have a God that is more powerful than Pharaoh. We have a God that is giving us the law, is going to make us a nation. We have a God who's going to take care of us. No. We want to go back to Egypt. In Luke chapter 9 and in verse 57, there are people coming to Jesus who say that they want to follow him, It happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus says, and you hold on a second. You need to understand what that means. In verse 58, Jesus said to him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You need to understand what it means. If you're going to follow me, understand the price that must be paid. The struggle that you're going to face. He said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Verse 61, another said, Lord, I will follow you. But let me first go and bid them farewell who are out in my house. And in verse 62, Jesus said to him, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. See, it's not a looking back to think about how far the Lord has brought me from what I used to be to what I am now. That's not the type of looking back that Jesus is describing. That's not the type of looking back that Lot's wife had when she looked back at Sodom and Gomorrah. It is a yearning. It is a, I wish I was still back there. I wish I hadn't had to give up this and that. It is that that Jesus is condemning. Lord, I'll follow you, but first let me go and bid farewell. Jesus, when he addresses this, I want to go back and say goodbye. Is Jesus condemning saying goodbye to people? What he's using, this as an example, along with, Lord, I follow you. Well, be careful. To this other, Lord, let me bury my father. Is it wrong to bury your father? No. Lord, let me say goodbye. All of this was for the purpose of teaching these people that when you commit yourself to serving God, you cannot look back and wish that you had what you've given up. You can't look back and say, man, I wish I could still live like that. I wish I still had those friends and had those types of influences in my life. No one putting his hand to the plow. You become a Christian, you're in the path. You're doing the Lord's work. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. But then you look back, oh, look at what I had to give up. Oh, look at the Sanhedrin and all the influence and all the money that I could have had. Oh, I wish I could. Part of me wishes I could still be there. That's the mistake that Lot's wife made. That's the mistake Paul didn't make. And that is the mistake Jesus warns us to not make. In Leviticus chapter 26 and in verse 3. Leviticus chapter 26 and in verse 3. Contained within the law that Israel was given were two choices. One choice was obedience. You do what I tell you to do, and this is what's going to happen. The other choice was disobedience. If you disobey me, here's what's going to happen. And God laid them out completely. In verse 3 of Leviticus chapter 26, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you. And God goes on to describe what he's going to give them. And then in verse 14, but if you do not obey me and do not observe all these commandments and you despise my statutes and your soul abhors my judgments so that you do not perform all of my commandments and you break my covenant, I also will do this to you. See, one of the things that Jesus was teaching these people who wanted to follow him, but there were other things that they wanted to take care of first, is that you have a choice. You have an option. And one of the aspects to this, when God offers this to the children of Israel, Leviticus chapter 26, there are consequences to what you do. A lot of times consequences has a very negative connotation. But you know what? There are positive consequences and negative consequences. There are consequences of obedience. There's consequences of disobedience. And that's exactly what God is telling Israel. It's the same thing that Jesus is emphasizing to these people who want to be disciples. Okay, if you want to obey, obey. But stick to it. Don't look back with yearning. Don't allow your heart to go back to Egypt. In the Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verse 26, God, through Moses, says, "Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and the curse, if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after other gods which you have not known." Moses says, "I'm giving you your choice." Lot's wife had a choice: to obey the word of the Lord through the angel or not. But notice the relationship between the two points. That the idea of disobeying, was it just the fact that she was cognizant of disobeying? Or was it the fact that her yearning, her desire for where she's been, overrode her understanding of what she needed to do to be obedient to God? See, that's what sin does. That's how the devil tempts us. He makes it seem as if what we're doing is lesser than what we used to do. It's not as enjoyable. It's not as pleasurable. It's not as fun. And he lures us away. And we're not thinking about obedience and disobedience. We're thinking about what was fun. What's going to feel good? I want to kind of be back where I was. Kind of like an old friend coming home. I want to kind of go back. These two go hand in hand. The one overwrites the other. Because of my yearning, because of my longing, I'm not focused on obeying God, and I'm not thinking about the consequences of disobeying Him. That was the major issue Israel faced all the time, was that they got distracted all the time. Weren't thinking about the consequences of disobedience, but rather they got caught up in what they wanted to do. And then they found themselves suffering the consequences of disobedience. This is exactly what Lot's wife dealt with. God didn't spell it out for them. He didn't have to. God, through the angel, didn't say, "If you look back, I'll turn you into a pillar of salt." But the commandment that was there, "Do not look back." Lot's wife broke that commandment. She wasn't thinking about the consequences of disobeying it. She was thinking about, "I don't want to leave. I wish I could stay. I wish they didn't have to get destroyed." She was longing for that place of sin and wickedness. And she didn't care at that moment about obeying God. That is the danger of temptation. Temptation can blind us to the consequences of disobedience. In 1 John chapter 2 and in verse 3, John tells us, "By this we know that we know Him if we keep His commandments. He who says, 'I know Him,' and does not keep His commandments is a liar. The truth is not in him. But whoever keeps His word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. And by this we know that we are in Him. He who says he abides in Him ought himself also to walk just as he walked." Practice what you preach. You claim to abide in him. Was it that Jesus said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments"? How many people do we know that are religious that would tell you a million times in a day, if they could, "I love Jesus, I love God, I love the Bible, I love the Spirit, I love the apostles"? And yet that most basic fundamental principle, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." That just, if God truly loves us, he's not going to hold us to his commandments. That's the thought process. If God really loves us, he's not going to hold us to these. And yet, John tells us, this is how we know
that we abide in Him. In 1 John chapter 5 and in verse 2, John says, "By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep His commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments." And His commandments are not burdensome. It's not to say that they're easy all the time. It is to say that they are not impossible to obey. They're not impossible to follow. They're not burdensome as if it's some sort of a huge weight that you cannot bear. John says, no, no, no. It also means, by implication, His commandments can be known. God hasn't left us without an understanding of what He wants from us. God hasn't left us without a standard of right and wrong. He has told us what He wants. He has told us what is right and wrong. And He expects us to obey if we want to receive the crown of righteousness. But you know, He's laid it out for you and for me. There is, for all of us, these two choices. To obey, what is the end result? A home in heaven. To disobey, to allow myself to be blinded by longing after what I have escaped, the consequence of disobedience is death. In Revelation 22 and in verse 12, Jesus says, "Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last." To which John says in verse 14, "Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city." Not blessed are those who want to do his commandments, but are really, they really miss what they left behind. Not those who enter through the gates into the city, but their head is actually turned back behind them. Those who have set their sights on heaven and they maintain that focus, forgetting those things that are behind and pressing forward. I'll leave you with one last thought this afternoon. This is, my head's in the way. This is a map. This is known as the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem up here. Here's Jericho. And all the way down here, this is where the Valley of Siddim is thought to have been. Here's Zoar here at the very bottom. And in this area, there are tons of salt deposits. In fact, the reason why it's called the Dead Sea is because the salt content of the water prevents anything from living in it. Plants die, animals die, fish die, everything dies. In fact, there's pictures, if you Google it, there's pictures of people trying to dive under the water and they can't. Because of the buoyancy of the water, so much salt, it's so dense, you can't dive in it. Ironically, it's one of the most dangerous places to swim because of the same reason. You get it in your chest, you get it in your throat, you will drown because it's so dense. All these salt deposits, all this area that existed, notice what is compared to from the Bible before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was a beautiful place. Beautiful plain full of plants, apparently. Because when God destroyed the cities, He didn't just destroy the cities, remember? And He didn't just destroy the people. He destroyed everything that grew. Everything that grew. Why salt? Why did God turn Lot's wife into... He could have turned her into anything. Why did He turn her into salt? And it makes me wonder. This area, it's suggested that these salt deposits at one time were deep beneath the earth. And some cataclysmic event caused this salt to be brought to the surface. Interesting, right? She longed to stay in this place. She literally became a part of its geography. Salt was already there. But then after the destruction, in fact, there's many biblical scholars that believe that after the destruction, that's when the Dead Sea became so salty. Originally, things were so lush and green and beautiful, but then after this terrible event, and all of this salt is exposed, Herite, this rock salt, that's when the Dead Sea became so salty, nothing could live. And it makes me wonder if it was, for lack of a better phrase, poetic justice that God turned her in to a pillar of salt. You want to stay here? You want to be a part of this place? I'll make you a part of this place. In the end, whatever the reason, her example remains as a memorial. Most memorials are good memorials. Remember those who have died fighting for our freedoms. The Lord's Supper, Christ who died for us, it's a memorial. But sometimes there are memorials that remind us of something bad, of what not to do. Lot's wife served the example for Jesus in Luke 17. Remember Lot's wife. Do not look back with yearning. Do not look back with longing. When you leave, you leave. And of course, the implication is there that those who listened to Jesus, they were Christians in 70 AD, they understood Jerusalem didn't mean anything anymore for a Jew, for a Christian. The temple, it wasn't the place where you had to worship God. And so to turn and to leave, you left with the understanding Jerusalem is no more, not only because it's going to be destroyed, but because it's no more in my heart. I don't identify who I am by Jerusalem anymore. I am a Christian. The end. That's the lesson for you this afternoon. Well, it might be beneficial for us to take a look at the context of Luke 17 and the prophecies associated with why Jesus mentioned Lot's wife, but then look at the text. Look at the background. Jesus used her as a memorial to warn others of what not to do. And that application does not only apply to the destruction of Jerusalem, it applies to us today as well. Let's make sure for those of us who are Christians that we aren't longing, we're not looking back at the wickedness that we've escaped, wishing we could still live in that life, trying to hang on in some way to some of the baggage that we left there or tried to leave or were supposed to leave. Let's make sure that we are forgetting those things that are behind. Learn from the mistakes. Learn from the past. Paul didn't forget it. But you leave it behind and you press toward that prize that the gospel calls us to, that home in heaven. We offer an invitation to those who are not Christians to be baptized, to have your sins washed away. Recognizing that Sodom and Gomorrah later continued to serve as examples for Jesus and for other writers in the New Testament of cities that endured judgment because of their wickedness. And Jesus even mentioned at times how that it would be better for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for you, Jerusalem, because you refuse to listen. Will you listen this afternoon? Will you make your heart right with God? We invite you, if you will, come as we stand and sing.